So the first condition is that it's onto. Note that if it is onto, then of course if you factor out by the kernel, it's one-to-one onto. By the open mapping theorem, it has a bounded inverse, and let MZ be the norm of the inverse. That's basically the best control you can get in the onto interpolation by the restriction map. And then the other two conditions are maps H2 onto L2. That certainly allows for the possibility that R could miss H2. Could miss little L2, although from the next condition that's equivalent, we see that can't be the case. R maps H2 into. Then there's this Carlson condition about tent. So there is a tent. If that's I, the arc I, that's T of I. And the Carlson condition is just that if you sum up the amount of mass associated with Z by that measure in the tent, it's at most the length of the arc I, some multiple of that. And the final condition is the strong separation condition involving the Blaska products. So one remark, first of all, last time we showed that 1 implies 5, and we actually showed that MZ, the norm of the operator, is equal to or greater than 1 over delta Z. Or actually we showed the other way, delta is equal to or greater than 1 over M. So we already have this left-hand inequality. And I claim that at the end of the day, we will have shown that MZ, that's the best control in the interpolation, can be obtained in terms of this delta by an upper bound 1 over delta times a bit more, an extra log. And even though we're not going to do it, I maybe should mention that this upper bound it can be achieved, so we have to put it in. If you look in Garnett's book, I don't want to do it here, but if you look in Garnett's book, you'll see that if you look at sequences like this, roots of unity shrunk down a little bit. You can easily compute the Blaska product according to these things because of the symmetry. And you can show that if you carefully control the number of points, that's the capital N in the nth root, and also the radius, as you go off to infinity, you can find examples where the of interpolating sequences where this relationship is roughly equal. MZ is roughly equal to this, and the delta goes to zero. Anyway, I don't want to do that, but just to point out that it really is that you can't improve the right-hand bound. Okay, so we're going to continue on with the proof. So we did 1 implies 5. This time we're going to do 5 implies 4. We're still in the upper half plane. And so that I don't make mistakes, let me get started in the right foot. Okay, so we want to show that the Carlson condition, testing on tenths, follows from the strong separation. And the first thing we're going to prove, we first prove a restricted version. The restricted version is we only look at tenths with their vertex already at a point in our sequence. The actual theorem says you have to test over all, I mean the actual condition, you have to test over everything. But let's first of all look at testing over tenths with vertex in the sequence Z. So fix K and now we're in the upper half plane. So looks like this. There's xk. This distance is yk. And now we have a couple of inequalities. The first one comes from this. Let's put it here. What is is this though? Like, I cannot remember this. I'll draw the graph this way, I guess. This is the. I shouldn't call it QYS. And the logarithm graph at the place of interest will be close to its tangent line, which is probably T minus 1. So all the action is going to take place around here as you go to the boundary, and so we're going to use this as an approximation for that. The actual inequality is, and then of course in my notes I made lots of stupid arithmetic errors, the constants go wrong, but we'll get it right this time. So the inequality is, well, first of all, I guess minus ln t, this one's easy, equals to greater than 1 minus t, for t positive. So copy this out and then see why it's true. Okay, well, what's the BK of ZK? This expression in here, if I took the absolute values out there, for example, this expression in here, which is apart from the factors you need for the Blaschke product, which remember, we're now in the upper half plane. Okay, it's the analog of this in the upper half plane. I should write it over here then. So dk of zk is the product j not equal to k of zj minus zk. Zj minus zk bar, I think. Let me just make sure. So the ZKs come on the first one. So the Blaschke product is you put the Z here, and you just take you leave out the K factor and put in ZK. That's the strong separation that's equal to greater than some constant. And of course, the final condition is the int of those things. Over k in this case. So if we just take the 2 out here, that should be immediate from the 1 over delta with the minus sign. And now we use the tangent line approximation. And what do we get? We don't use it just yet. So this is minus these guys. Minus that. And now we use the tangent line approximation. So that's equal to or greater than 1 minus zk minus zj. Zk minus zj bar squared. And that equal to 4 yk yj zk zj bar squared. Okay, so that's the tangent line approximation. And this one is just a straightforward calculation. You just put this over the common denominator, multiply the two things out, look at the real and imaginary parts, everything just works out to be exact. If you draw a picture, it looks reasonable. let me just leave it as a calculation. I'll draw the pictures for the other ones that come up. But for this one, I mean, you just expand this out. I did it, but it didn't look very revealing, so I didn't put it in the notes. But obviously everything cancels except the cross product terms. And in the cross product terms, the x terms cancel, but the y terms don't, and they just add up to this. So you just get exactly that. Okay. And also, there's a reverse inequality. The reverse inequality, of course, is going to get bad if you're too far away. So the reverse inequality is restricted. But let's at least record it now while we have the picture on the board. The reverse inequality is minus ln bk zk squared equal to or less than 1 plus 2 ln 1 over c times the same thing. J not equal to k for yj. And this is where c is the separation constant. The separation constant is, you just take a single factor there, and you have a lower bound. And the reason you get this in here is obviously because of the separation condition, that forces you to be not too far from where the action is. I forget which side. Anyway, you can see that the worst constant fits. I don't want to go through the motions for that. It's just piddly calculations. Obviously, it works for some constants. That, I guess, is kind of useful that we know it's that constant exactly. Okay. C is the separation constant. It's obviously, I mean, that's the constant you need there. Of course, you also know that the separation constant is equal to or greater than that, because this thing has multiplies this by a whole bunch of other stuff that's equal to or less than one. So this could be much smaller than that. Okay, so now we can easily estimate the sum in the tent. So where's the picture there? So here we have the points Z that live in that tent. And then what do we get? The sum ZJs in the tent. So this notation means the tent at ZK. I know I defined it initially to be, let's also call that I to be the interval at ZK. So the sum of these things, let's sum up the YJ. We're supposed to sum up 1 minus ZJ squared, which is comparable to this, between a factor of 1 and 2. So let's just sum these things up. And of course you write that as the sum so for each point in here, we have a yj, I needed to do something first. If zj is in the tent, so there's a zj in the tent, then the thing we need to know is that thing on the denominator, zk minus zj bar squared, well, what is it? Again, I don't really care too much about the exact constants, but we may as well be reasonable about it. So if that's zk, so then here's zj bar, and if we're looking at the distance between zk and zj bar squared.
Now we're trying to compute the measure of the tent.
Yeah, we're trying to compute the sum of the point masses. The
what is the definition of mu in the upper half plane? Is it in the definition?
Oh, in the upper half plane, it's the distance to the boundary still. Right.
So
So in the upper half plane, I could have just done that. So in fact, if in the upper half plane, the yj is exactly correct. In the disk, I used the 1 minus dj squared. Okay, what is this thing? Well, so this is a Pythagoras thing. So this is equal to, that's yk, and that's yj. So this is yk plus yj squared. That's the square of that, and plus that's just the x's. Xj minus xk. Well, what's an easy inequality for this? This is obviously equal to or less than 2 times the bigger one, which is the yk. So this is 4yk squared. And of course, what are the x's? The difference of the x's is actually less than yk, but let's just be sloppy and make it 5yk squared. Then we can do this sum. So this is equal to zj and tzk. And now here, we just use the fact that 1 is equal to or less than this over that. So you get 5yj yk squared over zk minus zj bar squared. All right, so just use this, the fact that 1 is equal to or less than that.
We had the equation
T
of I, right? And now we have Q.
This is in the upper half plane. Right, the theorem was stated in the disk.
What does T of the DK?
Oh, it means this thing. The tent.
The tent is associated with
the
R.
Right, and it's also it's an equilateral triangle. So it's associated, the arc now is an interval on the line. It can equally well be associated with the vertex. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the vertices and the so-called arcs.
And now each point, DK, we associate
this tent and the interval. Well, I said we're first of all going to prove a restricted version. This is the restricted version. And then we have to use a covering argument to get the general. We do have to prove the general one, though. See what?
6 yk squared instead of 5 yk squared in that sum.
Why? Xk is in the middle. Xj is less. But in any event, as I said, I really wish I could just write capital C here. That would because whenever I write a number, you tend to think it's sharp. It's not. So I'm a little bit hesitant about that. People, of course, have spent a great deal of effort trying to find out the best constants here. But so I don't even want to come close to that. We won't do that sort of thing. Although apparently Peter Jones's proof comes closer to a good estimate when we get there. Okay, so now we have this. I have to put equal to or less than because it's 1 is equal to or less than the extra factors. And now you see you just pull a yk out and you're left with this thing. So this is equal to or less than 5 over 4 times yk. So if I pull out the 5 over 4 times one of the yk's, I'm left with exactly this thing. And that's equal to or less than 2 ln 1 over delta z. By our inequality that was valid for all, in all cases. So that obviously, and yk of course is, so it's some constant times, and the constant is related to log 1 over delta times the interval there. Okay, so that was for the z gaze. Now, what happens if you have an arbitrary tent? Maybe here I'll just draw the picture because it really is quite simple. So this proves the restricted case. Where T of I is associated to one of the points in the sequence. The general case followed by a covering argument. And of course, since the covering argument is going to apply to the intervals on the line, and of course for intervals on the line you have best possible covering limits. So here's the picture. Here's the upper half plane. So suppose we have an arbitrary tent like this, and then we have some points of Z. Now there's points out here that we ignore, and then in here, maybe there's some points like that. I'll just draw a few. So to each one of these points, you can associate the corresponding little triangle, little tent. And in addition, the corresponding intervals on the bottom. So you get a collection of intervals. So choose a sub-collection of the IVJs contained in I. That's a sub-collection of these. Yeah, I was just thinking finite overlap too, but I'm thinking ahead and wondering if, in fact, that's exactly what I wanted here.
Yeah. The Zhukovich would give you finite overlap.
Well, the overlap is enough, right?
That's what the Zhukovich gives you. Yeah. Because, I mean, the points are at the center of the interval. So
yeah.
I mean, you cannot apply beta because you don't.
Except maybe I have to be a little bit careful. That's the thing that I was thinking about, because I was missing something. That's why I was puzzled. So we first of all want to look at a sub-collection of the maximal intervals. Thank you. That was the missing ingredient. We want to look at the maximal intervals. They still won't be pairwise disjoint. They're not dyadic. And then we choose finite overlap too from among them. They're partially ordered by inclusion. So as you can see here, this little one is contained in that one. And I guess I could have drawn another one over here where this one wasn't contained in that one. So in this picture, that orange one would be maximal, this orange one would be maximal, and those would be maximal. So you ignore all the intervals which are contained in another one that's contained in I. And you just look at the maximal intervals, ij, and you choose a sub-collection of them with finite overlap to those two. Now, there is another caveat here, which is easily handled, and in fact, this goes through the entire proof over and over again. It suffices to consider the case when the sequence is finite and prove your inequalities with constants independent of the number of elements in the sequence, and then you just let the sequence grow. This is an example where it's convenient to do that, because for a finite set of intervals, you obviously just start choosing them. Pick the one on the left and go and just have overlap too. If they're infinite, you have to fuss, and we don't want to fuss. Some of you are looking surprised. I can't remember. I just don't want to do the infinite case. So the fact that Z, you can assume, and assume Z finite for this, obtain the ultimate estimate, then take limits. So for the covering lemmas, we can actually have it very, very simple. Okay, so maybe I should have... I said I wasn't going to write out the proof, but since I actually momentarily got stuck, I probably should say something about it. Let's start here. No, I'm talking about the intervals now. I'll just grab a picture. So we have, corresponding to every tenth, there is an interval. We're only looking at the intervals now. So let's draw the picture over here, and we're only looking at the maximal intervals. So there's only finitely many of them. So they may look something like... like this. I mean, it's hard to... that joined up with that, and I guess that joined up with that, and that one joined up with that. Anyway, you pick the first one on the left. And then you pick, of the remaining intervals, you pick the one that intersects this and sticks out the furthest. So, yeah, this one, I guess, that stuff for that. So in this case, it would be this one goes out to there. Then, after you've chosen those two, you look at the one that intersects this and sticks out the furthest. It won't go back here, so it only goes back that far. So you get overlaps most too. That's the construction for the finite case, which is really simple. Doesn't involve any fiddling. So that's what we do with the intervals. Okay. So let E equal ZK correspond to the chosen ZKs, right? The ones that I just chose here. So, for example, that means in particular that that would be Z1, this one would be Z2, and then this one goes off the board, Z3. So those are the tenths. The tenths also have overlap at most two. So let E correspond to the chosen ones. Then you just arrange the sum according to these things. So the sum over all the ZJs in the original tenth of the YJs is equal to, well, you look over the Ks first. So that's the ZKs and E, the special ones. And then you simply sum over all the ZJs in, equal to less than, ZJs in T, I, ZK. So again, if I use orange for the Z's, there's some of the points are in there, some of the points are in there, some of the points might be in the intersection. So that's why the equal to a less than sign, because they might be counting more than once, some of them more than once here, most two. Anyways, the sum of all the orange ones that are underneath the big tent, each one of them is underneath one of these tenths for sure, and you just add them up. And so what do we put here? YJ. This thing, of course, we already have an estimate for it. Let me just write it like, let's not worry about the constants for a moment. At some constant times the length of ZK, that's this interval, but the sum of the lengths of the intervals have finite overlap too. So again, some other constant C times twice the total length that it could be, which is I. So that's the covering argument right there, the fact that the sum of the measures is at most two times, or the sum of the length is at most two times the length of the whole thing. So that over this whole thing, this is the interval I. And of course, this constant C still basically is a constant multiple of one. That's one over delta C. We'll get that sort of thing. The reason for the one ln. And the reason for the 1 plus ln is that as delta goes to 1, you don't want the thing to go to 0. Although I haven't checked it, I don't really know how much it's needed, but certainly throwing it in doesn't hurt. That makes it correct. Okay. So that's the Carlson box condition. And now we want to show that the Carlson box condition is sufficient for condition 3. That's the fact that the restriction maps into L2. So this is where our friend, the non-tangential maximal function from the HP theory comes in. So 4 implies 3. Okay, let's get the... So remember I said that whenever we're using condition 5, the infinite Blasker products, we work on the upper half plane because of our assumption that all the points are in a bounded thing means we can get rid of the funny factors that are annoying and just work with a really simple case. Whenever we do something that doesn't involve that, we work on the disk simply because that's where the theorem is stated and it's more familiar to me anyways. So, recall for F and H2, we have its boundary values are at L2 with the same norm. F is both the Poisson and Cauchy integrals of its boundary values. And we define NF at EI theta to be, so that's EI theta. And you just take any ball of smaller size, say a half, just to be to fix matters. And you take the soup over that thing. So this is the soup over that thing of the modulus F of Z. So Z is in there. So you're taking the soup not only over the radius that happens to go from the origin to EI theta, but even on a cone around it. And remember that part of our theorem in the HP theory was that in this particular case, the integral of nf squared was some constant times f star. Squared, followed from our theory of HP functions in the disk. Actually, we proved this by using the known theory for the Poisson integral, harmonic functions. So we actually avoided all the technicality of dominating the non-tangential maximal function by the Hardy-Littlewood maximal function on the circle, and then that's bounded on L2. But anyway, just reminding you that there was a lot of real analysis in that theorem that we assumed. Okay, so from all this, we now get, then the following picture. I wanted to choose that thing to have the right angle at the circle, as you'll see in a minute, because the following picture makes the proof really simple. If you look at the set where the non-tangent, this is the set of theta or EI thetas, in a circle, where the non-tangential maximal function is bigger than some lambda. First of all, n is easily seen to be lower semi-continuous. It's the soup of continuous things. And therefore, this is an open set. And we can write this uniquely . These are the components, the component arcs. So on the circle, let's just pretend there's a few, just a couple. So there's one, another one. There's three of them anyways. Three of the IJs. And this thing is contained in the set of the set of Z's where F is bigger than lambda is contained in the tenth corresponding to those things. So here's the, if that's IJ, here's the tenth corresponding to IJ. Here's the tenth corresponding to that one. Corresponding to that one. And the proof of the following statement is just look at the picture. So we have this and the set of Z's in the disk such that F of Z is bigger than lambda is contained in the union of the TIJs. Let me make sure I've got that right. Right. And how do you see this? That's because at every point that's not in this set, that means if you're outside the IJs, there's a point where you're outside the IJ at an endpoint. By definition, the non-tangential maximal function is equal to or less than lambda there. And if the non-tangential maximal function is equal to or less than, then on this thing, we have F equal to or less than lambda. So for every point outside the intervals, you have this. And obviously, if you do this for all the green points, the only things left are the white things. So that's the proof. The only catch is I have to arrange for the angle of these straight lines on the green things to match the angle of the white ones, and that you can do. Roughly 45 degrees. So, and now, of course, because of the Carlson condition, we can get an estimate for the distribution functions. Ah, okay. So first of all, I claim that I can arrange matters so that the in other words, I have to choose the size of this ball in here in such a way that these lines, say, come in with exactly the same angle that the tenths leave from. So we also have tenths defined like this. There's a certain angle here that has to match this, or at least come close. I don't know if it can be exactly matched. I haven't thought about it, but it can be close. Certainly in the upper half plane, you can make them match exactly. So anyways, you make them match like that. And now, over here, by definition, the union of all the open intervals IJ, or arcs, is exactly the set where the non-tangential maximal function is big. That means that on the complement of these red intervals, so the red intervals are the sets where NF is big, NF bigger than lambda on the red things. But NF is then equal to or less than lambda on the complements. So maybe I should call them yellow. Now, this is a closed set. So there's this closed set in between on which NF equal to or less than lambda. And now I call those, I look at the green thing I called it here. If you pick a point on the set where NF is equal to or less than lambda, by the very definition, that means that the sup of F in this whole thing is at most lambda. So that means that on this range here, mod F is equal to or less than lambda. But you can do this for every point outside the red thing. And you can see that they cover everything, if you fill them all in, they cover everything but the little white things. So the only possibility is that this must be contained in the things. Anyway, this is a clever observation. I think it was Stein who first observed this. Carlson's original proof actually gave more information. He used generations and showed there was a geometric decay in the generations, which I think can be useful in some problems, or maybe useful in some problems. I haven't come across them yet, but it's there. And then Stein noticed this this duality between the tense and the non-tangential maximal function, which you get it immediately now. Because from this, from this we can get a distribution function inequality that the mu z measure of the set where this is big is dominated by the sum of the constant times the sum of the mu z measures of the tenth, and of course that is dominated by the sum of the measures of the lengths, but that is just the measure of that. So that's the connection, and that gives us the intimus, or inequality. So, if we look at the mu measure of this, is the set of F of Z is bigger than lambda. So that's my notation for mu measure of a set is then equal to or less than the sum over the J's of the mu z measures of the tenth. It's just the set additivity. And then each of these is some constant times the sum over J, the Lebesgue measure of the IJs. But the IJs are pairwise disjoint. They're the open components of that open set, so they're, that last thing is just the measure, Lebesgue measure, of the set where NF is bigger than lambda. Of course, this lives in the circle, and this is Lebesgue measure or d theta measure on the circle. This is the mu measure in the disk. Remember, mu lives in the disk, and out here, this is just Lebesgue measure on the circle. Well, now you just integrate this thing, and so what do you get? You get that the integral of f z squared d mu z is, of course, equal to, well, you can write this by Fubini's theorem. This is real analysis. You can write this by Fubini's theorem as and you apply Fubini, and you get this is the integral of 2 times t times the mu measure of the set where F, I should use lambda, 2 lambda, the measure of the set, the mu z measure of the set, is lambda. And the reason is you just write out the mu z measure of this set as integrate mu z over a characteristic function of an interval, and then you do the integration the other way around, you get that. So it's Tonelli's theorem. Because there's no cancellation. It's all positive stuff. Okay, or if you like, this is integration by parts. But the way you prove it is by Tonelli's theorem. And now you use this as equal to or less than, and you put this in. So this is 0 to infinity, 2 lambda, the Lebesgue measure, NF, bigger than lambda, d lambda. But by the same token, this is the integral over the circle of nf squared. Lebesgue measure. Again, just integration by parts or Tonelli's theorem again. And this constant, the constant, of course, depends on 1 plus ln 1 over delta z. It should be in there, but I'm just leaving it out. And now, what's the final thing? NF squared. Now you use all this real analysis involving the maximal theorem and all the things we haven't proved here. You eventually get F star, which, by the way, is just H2 norm of F squared by the theory we had. So this is equal to less than some bigger constant times the H2 norm squared. Oh, and of course, the final thing is, why did we consider the measure mu z? I guess we haven't come against it yet. The reason is because this, by definition, is the sum. This is the sum of fj squared, because the measure is point masses at zj's, and the masses are these things. That's the sum over j. And that's exactly the L2 mu z norm of the sequence FZJ, which is the restriction of F. So finally you see the connection, that the restriction of F maps into this, the norm in the target space, L2 mu z, when you square it, is exactly this, which is that. That shows us that R maps H2 into. And it's bounded, and moreover, it's bounded by some multiple of this. The multiples keep getting bigger with every line. But they're universal constants times that. So R H2 into L2 mu z bounded by, well, this that constant, of course, was with things squared. If you actually want the norm of the operator R, you take the square root. So it's bounded by square root, some constant times the square root 1 plus ln. So let's keep track of this, because this is what will eventually give us that estimate I mentioned at the beginning. Okay, so now we have proved what have we done so far? We have 1 implies 5, implies 4, implies 3.
In this last argument, did the exponent 2 play any special role? It looks like it goes for period.
Yep. All p's between 1 and infinity. Exactly. So in fact, what you could have said, there's more things you can add to this list. Given a p between 1 and infinity, R maps H2 into L2, and then there's a corresponding change in the weight for the measure mu. So you call it mu sub z p. And also you could put R maps HP onto L2 of mu sub z p. Everything else stays the same. The interesting thing is that if you change the H2 to an HP here, none of the other three conditions change. That's because the Carlson condition for embedding, see what the fact that 4 is equivalent to 3 is called the Carlson measure theorem. You identify for what measures does H2 embed into a weighted L2. You can even consider a more general case than this, and it turns out it's if and only if this condition. And the condition is the same for all HP spaces. Similarly, H infinity is the multiplier algebra of H2, and that doesn't change either. It's also the multiplier algebra of HP. So yes, the conditions 2 and 3 can be replaced by P versions. And it's still a theorem. I just thought for the start we wouldn't do that. Maybe one thing I should just do, because we have to do it today anyways, before the, we have a little break, just one more thing before the break, and then we have to do, it's actually pretty easy to do 3 implies 4 implies 5, and then finally 5 implies 1 is harder. But one thing we will need, and then we have to bring 2 into it at the very end. One thing we need, however, is a remark. Just want to prove this before the break. M of H2, by definition, this is the multiplier algebra of H2. It's defined to be the set of functions phi on the disk such that phi f is in H2 for every f in H2. In other words, the functions on the disk that when you multiply them by H2 functions, you stay in the space H2. At this point, they're just arbitrary functions, measurable functions. So the claim here is that, and obviously this is an algebra because if you take two of these guys and you multiply them, you just multiply the thing twice, you're still in H2. So we actually claim that MH2 is H infinity. And with equivalence of norms, I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself because with equality of norms, sort of jumping ahead of myself because at this point we haven't really even pointed out that the elements in here give rise to bounded operators, so. But let me just prove this now. So define the following. Define M phi mapping H2 into H2 by F goes to BF. Right? And this is for phi in the multiplier algebra. Define this. This operator is obviously well defined because by definition, phi f is actually an H2 function. The thing is obviously linear. I claim it's easy to see it has closed graph. Maybe first of all, I should point out that first, phi times the function 1 is an H2. So first of all, phi is holomorphic, it's an H2. You get that for free. Also, graph of MV is closed. I'll leave that as an exercise. It's just against the game. The point evaluations are continuous on H2. Graph is closed implies MV is bounded or continuous. Then, well, there's more than one way to do this, but I like the following method because it will give us something very useful. Now observe the following. Well, this is remarkable the first time you see it. Remarkable equality. It's not so remarkable when you've lived with it for a while, but at first glance, it's quite amazing. Suppose we look at the following. Let KZ zeta be the reproducing kernel for H2. That's 1 minus Z bar zeta. The reproducing kernel. H2. Reproducing kernel, you remember that in any Hilbert space, it's easy to see that point evaluation is a continuous linear map. Therefore, it is given by inner product with something, and that something is unique. This is Hilbert space theory, just trivial. The fact that this thing actually is an H2 and works as for the reproducing Hilbert kernel is Cauchy's formula. I mean, we did this before. You just write it right out. This reproduces the. So that must be the unique reproducing kernel. And it turns out that if you look at the adjoint of a multiplication operator, this is what you call a multiplication operator, one of these guys, pointwise multiplication operator. If you look at the adjoint of it on a reproducing kernel, you get the following, at first glance, miraculous thing. It's MCF KZ. Of course, M phi is nothing but phi f, and we know now that phi is holomorphic, right? It's an H2. So it's holomorphic. KZ, okay, so for f slightly restricted, so that phi f is actually still an H2, this then just becomes, by definition, phi z f of z. This equality here requires, let's say, f in H infinity, because when I multiply it, I want to remain an H2. If phi is an H2, this has got to be an H2 function. There's a good order for us to do this, although there's other ways you can get around it, but let's do it this way. Running out of white chalk. And now you use the fact that this is equal to phi of z. Now, f of z can also be written as f tested against the reproducing kernel. H infinity functions are clearly in H2. And this is then, this is a number. You can put the number back inside here, putting a complex conjugate over it. So this is phi of z bar kz. And this is for all f in H infinity, which is, of course, a dense. Pardon? Oh, because I wanted phi f to be an H2. No, phi is an H2. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's for all f's in H2. Very nice. It would have worked anyway, but it works a lot better like that. Very good. Okay, so what does this say? Since this is true for every f in H2, that means that this element in the Hilbert space is this one. That's quite amazing. It says that the reproducing kernel is an eigenvector for the operator mc star, and its eigenvalue is phi z bar. I mean, we'll put it in just in a second, but you know right away that the eigenvalues, the sup of the modulus of the eigenvalues, is bounded by the operator norm. The operator norm of mc star is the same as m phi, so you immediately get that the sup norm of phi is bounded by the operator norm of m phi, which says that you're in h infinity. So you got that for free. I'll just put it here. Let's write all that out. So the modulus phi of z, which is times the norm of kz in H2, of course, that thing is m phi star of kz. So I'll write this out. This is m phi star of kz, right? Because m phi star of kz is just equal to that phi z bar times kz. So that's why that came out. And then this is equal to or less than the norm of m phi star on H2. But adjoints have the same norm. Hilbert space. And then here you just use the operator norm, kz. And now, of course, you can cancel the norms of the kz, and we see that the L infinity norm of phi is dominated by m phi operator norm. So our converse is trivial. Conversely, the MV operator norm is equal to or less than the sup over f, not zero, of what is it? It's phi f in H2 over f in H2, But if you look at the definition of H2, you can pull the soup norm of phi out. You know, remember, it's the integral of L. If you take the L2 norm of this thing over circles, you take the limit, this thing can come out as the L infinity norm. So, we finally conclude that our phi is an H infinity with equivalence of norms. Its norm is the same as the multiplier object. This argument also goes through for HP. Gives you that the multipliers of HP are H infinity. But anyways, we will use this argument when we finally get around to showing that 2 is equivalent to everything else. So let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and complete the proof of this theorem. And then Thursday, we still have a little bit more functional analysis to do. And then the week after that, I think we'll just go with these lectures, Tuesday and Thursday. And we'll do Peter Jones's proof, and then we'll do the Corona theorem using that proof. And then the week after that, we'll hopefully get into either tuplets and Hankel operators or some of the higher dimensional theory. We might do the higher dimensional theory first because I think, I would say this to spur myself on, I think Richard and I have a proof for the interpolating sequences for the Drey-Arvidsson space. It's been just missed up until now. But, so having said that, that'll force me to work really hard and try to get it. So if so, we'll do that the following week. Okay, so we'll put this off for a few minutes. Okay, so let's continue with closing the loop for 3, 1, 3, 4, or 5. Still leaving 2 out. Remember, the reason I'm kind of doing this is that in other situations, 1, 3, 4, 5 are all equivalent. Not by quite these arguments, but something pretty similar. Whereas 2 is different. 2 is sometimes not equivalent to the others. So we'll do that at the end. 3 implies 4. Let's see. In the disk, we test the embedding H2 contained L2 mu over reproducing kernels. But first, of course, all we're assuming here is containment. We obviously need some control. So the first thing you notice is that we test the restriction. I think of it as an embedding, but it's a restriction over reproducing kernels. But first, we have to establish that R has some control. Well, again, R has a closed graph, always does in these sequence things. And since it's by the closed graph theorem, it's continuous. First, we note R is bounded by the closed graph theorem. And then we notice that KZ the F we're going to test over is KZJ, the one corresponding to a point in the sequence, not just an arbitrary Z. Right. We're going to test over a KZJ. And what this will give us is the Carlson condition at the tenth ZJ. So we get the restricted Carlson condition this way. And then you apply that covering lemma and you get the full thing. Right, so from the embedding, then KZJ at Z, if Z is in the tenth, so here's ZJ. If Z is in the tenth at ZJ, then of course you have the following. This is ZJ bar Z, which is roughly 1 over 1 minus ZJ bar squared. Because you're looking at ZJ bar times a Z in there, and you're getting roughly the modulus of ZJ squared within a very close. So, I mean, even if it goes up to the boundary, it still looks like 1 minus mod ZJ. So then K of Z is approximately that for Z in the tenth. And we get from the fact that R is bounded so let's write out, as we've done before, write it out in the middle. RF in L2 mu Z squared, just by definition, this is the integral of, let's not use F, let's use KZJ. So this is, of course, KZJ. Right? Just that's by the definition of the measure, it's exactly that. And then this is equal to or greater than what? Well, some small constant times the small constant in the wiggle times this thing squared times the mu z measure of TZJ. So in this integral here, just restrict the integral to the tenth. Get something smaller. But then when you're on the tenth, KZJZ is bounded below by this thing squared. So 1 minus ZJ squared squared. So you get that. But now on the other side, we know that R is bounded. And this is the embedding norm of the measure mu z. I'll just call it a constant, times kzj h2 squared. That's by the fact that r is continuous. But this, so there's a whole bunch of magic that you play with reproducing kernels for Hilbert space. And eventually we'll see that we even can come up with a sort of Blaschke product, infinite Blaschke products with these things. What is the norm squared of this? Well, it's of course the inner product of KZJ with itself. But it's a reproducing kernel, so it reproduces the value of KZJ at ZJ. So this is KZJ at ZJ, the definition of reproducing kernel. And of course, if you put KZJ, and evaluate it, I wrote it over here, if you put in zeta equals z, you get 1 minus mod z bar squared. So now you just move those two powers over here, and you get the restricted Carlson condition. Less than some constant times, which of course is some other constant times IZJ. Right, because this is distance to the boundary, it's the length of the arc in that picture here. Right, the distance to the boundary is the same, roughly the same as the length of the arc, which is the restricted Carlson condition. But then that covering argument we had before depended on nothing. It just always worked. So we may have done it before on the upper half plane, but it's the same thing on arcs, so circle. So now apply previous covering lemma to get condition 3. And in fact, this constant here is the square of the embedding norm. So in fact, if we wanted to, we could actually keep track. Now that we have enough information and write this down, we could even keep track of all the various constants. R maps onto. So the important constant there is the norm of the inverse map from L infinity back into H infinity mod the kernel of R. That was the control thing there. I haven't introduced this one. For R maps into here, this could be the embedding constant. Let me call this H2 Carlson. The definition of that thing, that's the H2 Carlson norm of the measure mu, is the embedding. This is where the word embedding comes from. The embedding constant of H2 contained in L2 of mu z. I mean, you don't have to mention the restriction map. Once you have this sum of atomic masses, of course, that restriction map being bounded into L2 mu is equivalent, as we've observed here. These two norms are the same, even with an arbitrary F there. So simply the embedding of H2 into a weighted L2 space. That's it turns out to be the same, yes. But I'm just saying, more generally, you could define for any measure mu, not just this measure mu, take an arbitrary positive measure on the disk. You can define its H2 Carlson measure norm as the norm of this embedding. And Carlson's theorem tells you that this embedding, the Carlson measure norm is finite. In other words, there is an embedding, if and only if the more general measure satisfies that same inequality on tens. So there's a more general version of this that will play a role later. Yeah, that's the idea of the theorem. Yeah, you just basically test it on a tens. You pretend So you're supposed to be testing over H2 functions. We just noticed that if you test over reproducing kernels, you get that condition. The reproducing kernel is basically big here and small there. The reproducing kernel looks like a normalized factor times the characteristic function of the tent, roughly. That's the way you should think of it. That the reproducing kernel looks like the characteristic function of a tent plus stuff that you can ignore relative to it. So therefore, it's enough just to test over those things. You can pretend these aren't holomorphic functions, but it's as if these were holomorphic functions and you were allowed to test over them, the characteristic functions. That's the intuition behind it.
Yeah. Support actually of the measures.
And then we use covering element to get the bigger picture. For an arbitrary measure, you just do it, you have to do it from scratch. It's a different proof.
Works for arbitrary measure. So you can take KBJ, just take any lambda as it is, any lambda as it is, you associate an R on the boundary,
mm-hmm.
vice versa. And then you use the same method here. So if you take point V in this.
Mm-hmm. For the necessity, yes. And for the sufficiency, it's the same as the argument we gave with the non-tangential maximal function. So in fact, the details are there already. As Brett just pointed out, the necessity is the same proof, and the sufficiency is the same proof. Just replace mu sub z by mu, and go from there. Because in the other proof involving the non-tangential maximal function, we never used vertices, etc. And as you pointed out here, you don't have to test on the KZJ. You could just test on the KZ. I could have done that here, too, and would have saved myself some writing. Thank you for pointing that out. I could have, instead of testing on the KZJ to show that it worked for every one of these, I could have just taken away the J. Could have just taken away the J. Then I have to change this one to something like a W. That's just Z still, and this is W. Yeah, that works better. Thanks. Okay, so we have two improvements so far today. Good. So mu Z is the constant that you associate with this. Here, this constant C, let me call that the best constant you can put there. Let me call that C sub mu z. Just C sub. It's the constant in the Carlson condition. It turns out that this thing is basically the square of the other ones. I mean, we're showing that all of these constants are comparable to each other, but this one is the square of the other ones because this was obtained by applying to F squared. All the other constants should basically be comparable in a linear way, and this one is the square of the others. And of course, down here, it's the delta that's the important constant. So you can actually keep track of. And in this last argument, I guess the reason I wanted to mention all that was that in this last argument, we get this. Now apply the cover. Okay, so we don't need this anymore. Just do it directly with the KZ. To get 3 with, and we can actually even get, we've got, so what did we prove here? We proved, no, 4. We're getting the Carlson measure condition from the embedding, and what you get is that C mu Z is dominated by the embedding squared, because here is where you use the embedding, and you're squaring the embedding norm, so you get you get C mu Z equal to or less than some constant times the Carlson embedding norm. See, it's a little bit unfortunate because the two halves of Carlson's theorem are, on the one side you have this condition and on the other side you have the mapping. People refer to often the norm of the embedding as the Carlson constant, and people also refer to the constant in the testing condition as the Carlson constant, and it's a little confusing, but we'll try to keep it straight. Okay, finally, 4 implies 5, and then the harder one, 5 implies 1. So 4 implies 5 is just a simple adding up. And since we're trying to do 5, we'll once again work in the upper half plane. Okay. And this is, well, it's really easy if you start correctly. Okay. So what we're going to do, of course, is show that the BK, ZK is bounded below uniformly. So let's pick one of the ZKs. There's the XK, the YK. And now we're going to look at the following sets. They're going to be arcs this time, just for convenience. I could make them triangles, but and then you, so that'll be S0. This bigger one will be S1. So the S1 is the annulus. S2 is... So we could actually give a definition of these things. Sn is a set of U's in the upper half plane such that Z minus XK is equal to or less than 2 to the n YK. Except, of course, let's just keep them as, let's not do the annulus, just Sn is the whole thing. And we'll do the annulus by writing Sn minus 1 in a minute. So then, what we're going to, of course, what we want to show is that the sum over J of 4 YJ YK over ZJ minus ZK bar squared, as you sum in J, we want to show that that quantity is bounded, because then we can use that reverse inequality we had before to bound the minus log of the BK ZK. But first, let's do this one. Okay, so in the, first of all, we'll sum over the ZJs in S0. That's this one. And what do we get to sum over? I claim YJ over YK. Okay, so that means we have to look at this thing, and you take out the YJ, so the ZJ minus ZK bar is that distance. And that's equal to or greater than YK. So when you square it, it's equal to or greater than YK squared. So you 1 over YK is an upper bound for that. Of course, that's going to be a good term, because by the Carlson condition, on the with just fatten it a little bit, go to a point a little bit bigger, you can see that the sum of the YJs will be dominated by that. That term is OK. And then the rest of them will work because of the in the square here, you get a geometric extra geometric factor, 1 over 2 to the n, that adds the rest of them up. So I'll just put constant, then I don't have to fuss about it. N equals 1 to infinity, and then you sum up over the ZJs in Sn minus 1. And now in this particular case, if you're way out here, for example, with a ZJ, then you get the estimate is YJ over 2 to the 2n YK. And the reason is because the ZJ minus ZK bar this time is on the level of 2 to the n YK. And when you square it, you get 2 to the 2n YK squared, but there was a YK on top, they cancel. And then we're done. This is just some by the Carlson measure condition. So on this circle, if you wanted to be accurate, you could go up a little bit, and then the tent will include it. But let's not fuss about that. So this is just some constant. And then in here, what do you get? If I took out the 2 to the n, the sum of the YJs in here, in this big thing, will be the length of this. But the length of that is 2 to the n YK. So you cancel everything but a 1 over 2 to the n. And that's the geometric decay factor that allows you to add it up. On the other hand, on the other side of this, by that reverse inequality, we had that this was equal to or greater than something minus ln that. So you get that is equal to or greater than the constant, and if you flip it around, you get that the delta is positive. With the right estimate. Okay, so finally comes the big event. The big event is showing 5 implies 1. Remember, what we've been doing so far is showing that the onto interpolation, which is the surprising thing, that it can happen at all, implies all these wonderful properties, and all those other wonderful properties are equivalent to each other. Now we have to do the hard thing, which is to show that those easily checkable conditions, like the Karlsson condition, actually take you back to the onto interpolation. Obviously, that's going to be hard. I guess we can finally erase the statement of the theorem. And this is where we're going to use the factorization of H1 as a product of H2, and we're also going to use duality. So it uses a lot of higher powered background. Okay, so finally 5 implies 1. We're back in the upper half plane. So we're going to suppose that Z is finite, and we'll get an estimate on that MZ that will be independent of dimension, and we can then just take a limit later. So we'll suppose that Z is finite, and recall that the Blaska product is this thing, Z minus ZJ, Z minus ZJ bar. And remember that B sub JZ is everything but the jth one. If you like, it's divided by the jth one. Now you just take that factor out. We'll need the following computation. We need to know what B prime of Z is. What is it? It's the sum j equals 1 to n of bjz times the derivative of this thing. What's the derivative of this? Oh, this is really simple by the product rule. This minus this, you just get zj minus zj bar. And underneath, you get, of course, that thing squared. So altogether, you just get that, and then we need to know that B primed at ZJ, of course, at the point ZJ, all of these factors vanish except the one with the same J, because so the only thing you get is BJ ZJ over that. BJ ZJ over ZJ minus ZJ bar, which, by the way, is what is ZJ minus ZJ bar? It's 2IYJ. So we get that. Okay. Now, we want to solve the interpolation problem. Well, since it's a finite sequence, it's easy to write down a solution. However, the solution will have a horrible H infinity norm, and that has to be corrected somehow. So, given AJ, they're obviously bounded, and interpolating a holomorphic function is, for example, just do the obvious thing. J equals 1 to n. Well, here you want to put down a holomorphic function that is 1 at ZJ and 0 at the other places. And that's pretty obvious what to do. The Blaschka product BJZ vanishes at all the other points and doesn't vanish at ZJ. So you make it 1. This function, it turns out, will work, but it's a little more convenient for the calculation later to change the function just a little bit using the calculation we did over here. So we can write this as, so what is the BJ? The BJ is this thing. So that's, this is BZ. What we're trying to do here, by the way, is in this candidate function, I'd like to factor out BZ. I'd like to factor out the Blaschka product, because in the next step, we're going to have to do that anyways. So I'd like to rewrite it first as BZ times something. It's a little bit easier to do later. So the BZ here is that over Z minus ZJ, ZJ minus ZJ bar. And then we have to divide by BJ of ZJ. BJ of ZJ is, let's write it this way. BJ of ZJ is ZJ minus ZJ bar times that. It's B prime ZJ times Z minus ZJ bar. Well, something happened that it's unexpected. So what is right. So I think that's everything, right? BJ of ZJ is this thing times B prime. And then I want to write this as BZ over B prime ZJ Z minus ZJ bar ZJ. I think I just twiddled them around. So there's the Z minus ZJ. The ZJ minus, that was Z. No wonder it didn't work when I was looking at it. Because they seemed to cancel, and I didn't think they should cancel. The Z minus ZJ bar comes up on top, and you still have the ZJ minus ZJ bar there. Good. So, remember, Z minus ZJ does factor into BZ, so it's a removable singularity. So this is still a holomorphic function. And this thing still, even without this factor, this will interpolate. The reason is because if you put in Z equal to, let's say, ZL, then all of these factors vanish for J not equal to L. And when J equals L, you get ZL minus ZL bar divided, you get 1 here. So it doesn't change the value. So this thing is 1 on the critical point, and you don't care where it is, where the other thing vanishes. So that means that we could take just the first part is our as our interpolating function. So we take g of z equal to b of z times the sum j equals 1 to n aj, oh, I'll put the bz inside, bz over b prime zj z minus zj. And this is an interpolating function. In other words, R of G is the sequence AJ. So it does the trick. And it's holomorphic. However, its norm could be quite huge. And as n goes to infinity, the H infinity norm of this thing can blow up and we'll not get a solution. We want to get solutions here with uniformly bounded H infinity norms independent of capital N, using only that the infinite product thing for n satisfies that delta is positive. That's condition 5. If H in H infinity vanishes at the finitely many points in Z, then G plus H, G plus H is also a solution. In other words, R of G plus H is AJ. So we can add arbitrary bounded holomorphic functions that vanish on Z in the hopes of trying to reduce the H infinity norm of this thing. However, by our theorem on HP that says we can factor out the zeros of an HP function without changing the HP norm by a Blaschke product, we see that H's in H infinity that vanish on Z can be written as something else, F's times the Blaschke product, where F has the same L infinity norm as H. So, however, the set of H's in H infinity, such that H equals 0 on Z, is equal to B times H infinity with equivalence of norms, or with equality of norms. In other words, if H is in there and it equals B times F, then the L infinity norm of H is the same as the L infinity norm of F. We've just factored out the zeros. Remember, B is the Blaschke product with zeros precisely Z. So this is a strong theorem already, right? The fact that you can divide out by the zeros and not change the norm. That's a huge, huge thing, which at first glance seems to only work in the disk, where you have Blaschke products and you can do this. So that means we can now write I'm actually going to check the notes, make sure I get it in the right order, since we're a little running out of time and I can't afford any mistakes at this point. So, the minimal H infinity norm of a solution to R of whatever AJ is the following. It's the infimum over all, well, I should have, anyways, in my notes I have the infimum over H's in H infinity of G plus BH, H infinity norm. Remember, our G was a bounded analytic function, it just could have had huge norm. We can now add anything like this. So now what I've done is I've interchanged the, what I could have done is put F here. If F vanishes, then G plus F also, G plus F. However, the set of F's in here is that, so F is that, and then I use H to be the bounded holomorphic thing that doesn't have the zeros there. Okay, so then we get that this infimum is the same thing as the infimum H in H infinity. And now remember, G has a B. Remember that for holomorphic functions, you can take the soup on the boundary. This is important, too. So not only did we have to factor out the zeros, we now use the fact that the norm is on T. You can express the soup as the soup of the boundary values, because that's important. So this is now going to be the infimum. We're now going to move to the boundary, where you can take out the B of Z. And what you get is, now of course it's going to be now infinity norm, 1 over B prime ZJ, Z minus ZJ, plus, and then you have the H. So again, what I mean here is the boundary values of all these things. And of course, since the Blaschka product has modulus 1, you can get rid of that. So more of the magic is taking place. Every step in this direction is some sort of magic. So now we use functional analysis. Yes. Yes, the reason I kept it here, though, is if I take it out, this thing has poles. But it's not holomorphic.
But B of Z
vanishes. Right, so they're removable. But I want this to be a holomorphic function, that's all.
I mean something else. If the G vanishes on all the points
in J. No. Because yeah, it has just one factor, Z minus ZJ, and it cancels. So that doesn't vanish.
But then
it's one on the ZJs.
In this case, is it allowed to do? Oh, because now we are on the boundary.
Yeah, this is very important. Yeah, every step here, every step is using very special properties of what we proved about HP theory. It's very important that the soup of H infinity in the disk, this is still in the disk, can be expressed as the soup of the boundary values on the boundary. That's what I did here. Then you can factor this out and it goes away because it's modulus 1 on the boundary.
And now the function that remains does not extend inside the disk.
Well, it's not this extension anyways. Not this extension.
But
no. This is not holomorphic anymore inside. So it's a meromorphic function, has boundary values, but now we're going to work just on L infinity. And now we have to use some duality. It's probably... I don't think we can actually finish it today, but this is the next big step, and I got this wrong in my notes. There's only two choices, and I quite often get the wrong choice. So now we're going to use that if we have Banach spaces, X and Y, we get the following. And this is where Y is a closed subspace of X. These are Banach spaces. And Y perp is a subset of X star, the set of continuous linear functionals on X that happen to kill Y, the annihilator of Y. And then there's a natural isomorphism between the X star factored out, modded out by Y tilde, with the continuous linear functionals on Y. This uses the Hahn-Banach theorem, which we haven't got to yet, but we will get to it on Thursday. And the choices that we're going to make here are x is L1 and y is H1. So H1 is a closed subspace of L1, and it turns out that if you work out the perp, the set of continuous linear functionals on x, of course, are L infinity functions. Remember, this is all in the circle. This is all in the circle. Are L infinity functions, and those that kill H1 are precisely the L infinity functions that are holomorphic. So they're H infinity. And we'll do this. We'll do this explicitly.
We are trying to compute this int for...
Yes, yes. Because this int is the norm of this thing as a that belongs to one of these cosets.
So we want to show that it is controlled by the norm of the AJ from...
We're going to show that we can... It's equivalent to take this thing and test it, again, by the Hahn-Banach theorem. You test it by all functions in the unit ball of Y, the unit ball of H1. So we're going to integrate this on the circle against functions in H1. Then we're going to apply Cauchy's formula, get a formula. Then we're going to take the soup over the AJs out first. Every step is really crucial, and then out pops the solution. But we're over time on it. But yeah, I think we probably should stop. It's about 2 or 3 minutes after. But this is really a nice argument, so we don't want to rush it. So we'll finish it next time. Also, we have the advantage that we will, by Thursday, I will make sure we cover the duality. So that'll be good.